You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.
Go Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this latest edition of Magnified with Matt Cooper, my podcast series of interviews with successful people from all types of backgrounds. All with the support of Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. You can move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business. And Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So our guest today is a Cork man who has had a varied business career since he left UCC in Cork 25 years ago. He is now the head of DAA, which is a short, of course, with the Dublin Airport Authority, but that also takes in Cork Airport and a host of foreign businesses as well, all under Irish state control. So Kenny Jacobs is going to talk about many of the issues in relation to the airports and the environment and future aviation travel. We'll also talk to him about what he gets paid in the job, which is a fraction of what he used to get when he was at Ryanair. And he remembers his time at Ryanair when he used to work for Michael O'Leary. He talks about his involvement in the supermarket retailing business with the likes of Tesco and lots more besides over the course of the next hour. I hope you enjoy our chat with Kenny Jacobs. Kenny Jacobs, thank you very much for joining us. The last time I met you, I was going out on my holidays out of Dublin Airport on a Sunday morning, and I end up at security getting my bags checked, and it was by you. Why were you doing that?
I do it as part of the team. It's good to do it. It's good to kind of throw yourself into the kind of the roles that make or break a passenger's airport experience. So I do that from time to time. Did it last weekend and I'll do it next weekend. You see how busy the airport gets. It's different between T1 and T2. And it just gives you an appreciation of the people who work for us working on security lanes. Also what the passenger goes through. You always learn something. And it's good to do. It's a good way to start a Saturday or Sunday morning sometimes.
So how often would you do it?
I try to do it during the summer. I'm going to try to do it one day a week.
For how long?
For 4 months.
No, but how long would you spend?
I'll do a shift of somewhere between 3 and 4 hours.
Okay. And do you do other types of work as well as that, the security scanning?
That's the one where you're actually doing the job. You will go round and see other roles, join certain teams as they're doing different things. You might pick up the trolleys from time to time. You might go airside and help out the guys marshalling aircraft and passengers from time to time. I've yet to do a number of things like go into the whole baggage system, but I have those on the list to do. But the most important way you can actually help out is actually in the security lanes over the summer, because that's really the one of the most critical roles that keeps the whole operation taken over.
How important is it for a corporate boss to know what the roles are throughout the organisation for which he or she is responsible?
I think really important. I don't know how you could run an operational business without knowing how they work, not just an appreciation, but also being able to roll up your sleeves and do the key ones. I mean, staff will see that and say, okay, he gets it. He's helping out. I think it sends the right message to staff. I think it gives you an appreciation of how challenging some of these roles are. And you see what you have to deal with. If you take security, where we met that Sunday, we met in T2, and it's got the whole new technology where you don't have to take electronics and liquids out of your bag. T1 has that in about a third of the machines. So we've got different setups between the two terminals, and that's a total different experience for staff having to manage those and for customers, passengers going through them. So I think it's essential that you know how airside operations work. I think it's essential you know how in-terminal operations work and that security works so that you can run a business that is essentially an airport's business.
When did you come to that realization about having to know how to do the things that you expect others in the organization to do? Did that come to you at what stage in your career?
When I worked at Tesco, because you had to do it. I always wanted to do it. And I spent most of my working life in retail, and I stacked the shelves in Dunn stores in Ballyvillan and Cork. So that always gave me an appreciation of rolling up your sleeves and getting stuff done, and gave me a love of retail. But in Tesco, they have a really good model called Helping Hands. And at Easter and at Christmas, everybody from the head office decants to the shops. And you don't just, you're not just there to be with staff, to be with the staff that are in the shops the whole time. You're there to do a job. So I think any boss that's going on the front line, be it shops or airports or whatever the business, you're there not to observe. You're there actually to be one of the team, roll your sleeves up and get stuff done. But really, it was Tesco that I really, really learned that you learn a lot, you do a lot. It's also just a great break from being in the office and corporate stuff, meetings, PowerPoint, all that stuff. That's important, but can also just be a bit of one scene. It's a change of scene. Time goes really, really quickly when you're doing security.
Does it? Because that's the thing I thought maybe people would fear, that they would find it repetitive and boring.
Oh, absolutely not, Matt. If I just take that morning I met you, you'll come across different types of passengers who know different things in terms of what they're supposed to do. You'll come across some people and it's like they've never flown before, even though you can tell by their baggage choice that they fly a lot. You'll see different things that people have in their bags. I mean, I met one person that same day who I asked them, have you any liquids in the bag? And they said no. Then they opened up the bag and it was literally like a gear bag full of liquids.
How do you deal with that then?
Well, you deal with that is you give them a small plastic bag and say, this is what you're able to bring.
Yeah, but I mean, are you nice to them or do you get grumpy with them?
No, you're always nice to people. Occasionally, look, passengers early in the morning, everybody is entitled to be a little bit grumpy. But I think you just explain it to them in terms of what they can and can't do. It's regulated, so there's not a grey area. You can't just say, go on, you're okay today. So you just tell them what they can and can't do. And then you try to move them out of the way so they're not decanting a big gear bag full of liquids into a small plastic bag that's got a litre capacity, you know, taking up a vital space on the security lane.
We have a couple of things in common, I reckon, because we're both from Cork City. We both did commerce degrees in UCC, but you would have been exactly a decade after me. You graduated in 97. I graduated in 87. You left immediately for England on graduation, which was something that was very common in my time in 87. I was one of the few who actually didn't go. But by the time 97 came around, wasn't that the plan when many people decided to stay in Ireland? So why did you decide to go?
I decided to go because I joined the Procter & Gamble graduate program. Why did I join? I knew I wanted to get out of Cork and have a change of scene. You're right.
That's a very brave thing to say about what to leave Cork. You know, better be careful. You better qualify.
I've never been back since. So there you go, two sins in one. I knew I wanted to go and see something different. I'd done an internship with Procter & Gamble as before my final year, and I liked that. You're right. In 1997, you didn't have to leave to get a job, so I was offered a few jobs in Ireland, mostly with the accounting firms, and that's the one then that your parents always say, of course you're going to go and join Andersons or KPMG. Look, the P&G one was great. It was London. They were paying very well, and I was working in sales and marketing, and you got a Golf GTI. So what's not to like? It was the bright lights, big city, biggest paycheck. And
was it a time as well when attitudes in London towards the Irish were changing?
They were. Now, I do remember a few incidents where I was like, wow, that's pretty scary what someone just said. But I remember being on I was there when there was a few bombing incidents in London, and a few people would turn to Irish people at the time and say, this is your lot. To which case I would have said, no, it's actually your lot, because they're from Northern Ireland. They're not citizens of the Republic. But I love England and I love English people. But it was interesting just to be there as a young person as those things were working out, thankfully, of the system and the relationship between Irish people and English people, which I think is generally a very positive relationship. But that was an interesting eye-opener for me to see that. Now it's so interesting to see the full circle that it's that I think it has gotten. That's a very positive thing.
Okay, so you spent how long in England?
I spent three various stints working in England. I'm now 50. I left Cork at 25. I would say in those 25 years I've been working, I was probably in England for 12 to 15 years.
Okay, so, but did you ever think of staying there permanently?
Absolutely. Our kids were born in Dublin, but they grew up in South Cheshire for the first 8 years of their lives, and they loved it. And then we came back when I took the job with Ryanair, and we really loved it. It depends on where you are. We lived in St. Albans. I lived in London. We lived in a place called Hale in South Manchester, which is where other great Corkonians like Roy Keane and Dennis Irwin would live. And it's an idyllic lifestyle. It's really, really a beautiful part of England, really close to a really great city, Manchester, which I think is a really vibrant city. If you like music and you like sports, there's no better place to be. Has a similar feel to Dublin for me in many aspects. And I really like it. I love going back over for concerts, for Man United games, and just to be in what I think is a cracking city. So we really liked it there. We were reluctant to come back. We're now really happy we came back. We have a good life here in Dublin. We live in Dublin 4. Kids are in school in the south side. And I love this town. It's a really, Dublin's just the right size that you'll never get bored. You can navigate your way around it. And if you get annoyed with the rain, you can just jump on a plane and head to the sunshine.
Are you so divorced from Cork? Are you going to Croke Park on Sunday to support the Hurlers?
I am going to Cork. Of course I'm going to Cork to support the Hurlers. So, and it's great going home. Cork, you do get that feeling when you're driving down. That this is home, and there'll always be a few stopping off spots between Lennox's, a few favourite pubs like Dan Lowry's on McCurtain Street, that kind of just define your Cork memories that are wonderful. And Cork Airport, I'll go down to, I'd say probably six times a year, and it's fantastic. It's, for me, even before I took this job in DAA, it's a fantastic regional airport, really, really well run. We want to grow it significantly, and I'm convinced that will happen.
Hang on now a second. I remember when you were head of marketing at Ryanair, and you weren't as positive about Cork Airport and at the time. It all depends on what job you're in, doesn't it, boy?
It absolutely does. and look, that's good. That's good inside knowledge to have, to know how to make the growth this very future-proof, the growth this time around.
Okay, but let's go back a little bit to Cork. You said you learned how to stack shelves in Dunn Stores in Ballyvolan. So does that suggest there was a work ethic there from an early age encouraged by your parents?
Yeah.
Or was it yourself wanting?
I think both. Even before I would have started working in Dunn's at the age of 16. Before that, I would have spent my summers working for my dad, who was a plasterer by trade, who would have had his own construction company. So yeah, in the summers, You weren't hanging around. You were in the back of a van heading out to do labouring, really from the age of 13, which I liked because it gave you a structure. It was a bit of a workout, and you got cash at the end of the week, which was great. I was mad into sports and music at the time, so all that money would have been spent on McCurtain Street, either in Crowley's buying stuff for my drum kit, or in various record shops. But
do you still play the drums?
I still play the drums.
What sort of stuff do you play?
I would mostly play, I'd play a bit of everything, but I would get behind a Sonar drum kit and I would play everything from AC/DC, Kings of Leon, and a lot of jazz stuff.
Jazz?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Are you good?
I was pretty good, yeah.
Do you ever play in any bands?
I've played in a good few school bands and a couple of bands in college, and then you kind of gave it up. But I still, it's great therapy. Once you're playing an acoustic kit, an electric kit's not quite the same. But it's really, really good to do. I would have on my bucket list to get back into a band because I would love to spend Sunday afternoons playing jazz music in some cozy little pub somewhere in Dublin.
Well, far from jazz, but will you be at AC/DC when they come to Dublin in August?
Unfortunately, I would be in Ile de Ré with family on holidays.
Okay.
So otherwise, I would.
Okay. And what about sport? What's sporting background in Cork?
Sport. So I went to CBC in Cork, which would have been a rugby school. So I would have played, would have been playing rugby there, and I would have played tennis on Sunday as well. And then I would have swam up in Mayfield. They would have been the three sports. And then you go to anything that Cork's in. So at the time, we would have seen that Cork team, when Cork were really competitive, not just in hurling, but in football. So you would have grown up in that era and gone to Páirc Cuíve at the time and to Croke Park whenever we made finals, which was a lot more back then. But it's great to be heading there this Sunday.
Isn't it just? Mm. But it actually brings up this thing about the role of Cork as a city, because, and this is relevant to the airport, because recently on The Last Word, when Roderick O'Gorman, the new Green Party leader, was on the programme, I brought up with him about the capacity issues at Dublin Airport. And he started pushing the banging the drum again for regional development around Cork and Shannon airports. So where are we with that? I mean, where do you see the DAA's role in developing Cork Airport? Because I'm sure you know many people who are still living in Cork, and it can be a thriving place which can be developed further. What's your role in that?
Our role is the role. I think we're ultimately responsible, and I'm responsible for growing Cork Airport together with the Cork management team, and the DAA board fully support that. I think that's always been the part of DAA's role. It's not just about Dublin. The name is slightly misleading, but I do view it as being the Cork and Dublin Airport Authority, and it's massive responsibility of mine to grow Cork Airport, and I think it can. So look, I was down there 2 days this week. We announced a new incentive program for Cork Airport for any airlines that, while Dublin is capped and they can't get the slots that they're looking for at Dublin, which is definitely going to be the case in 2025 and 2026, that if those airlines relocate aircraft from Dublin to Cork, we will give them the biggest ever incentive that's been available at Cork Airport. That's not just what we're doing. The biggest thing that we'll be doing is expanding Cork Airport to give it the pier capacity, the terminal capacity, so that it can grow. I think,
was that not all done when there was a very expensive rebuild of the terminal about 10, 15 years ago?
It was done to the tune that, you know, Cork this year will do slightly over 3 million passengers, and the existing Cork terminal could take 4 million passengers. Now, it's a very peaky schedule in Cork, you know, a busy first wave, then it gets quiet, then it gets busy again. I think in Ireland, we need to get better at taking a long-term view of infrastructure. If you go out to the year 2050, and some people would say, sure, that's ages away, but it's only 25 years away. And 25 years in aviation goes pretty quickly. But if you take 2050, and if you look at the CSO projections on population in Cork, and they traditionally lowball it, you know, we're going to need a Cork airport that can handle over 7 million passengers by the year 2050. Now, we're getting on with the plan that's called a master plan for the airport that will describe how do we get there, which is you knock the old terminal and then you extend out either side with new piers and you stick in a mezzanine floor in Cork. And we want to showcase Cork as this is how you actually have build the infrastructure before you need it. In Dublin, what we're doing is building the infrastructure after we've needed it, because we're right up against the passenger cap. But we're committed to growing Cork. I think the government have a good plan of growing the city and county to a higher population. I think more businesses are looking to relocate there. And again, I always come back to, when I lived in Manchester, I saw it with my own eyes that, wow, Manchester really is the second city of England. And I think Cork should emulate that from in every aspect, from a business point of view, sporting, music point of view. The university is great and it's expanding. So we want the airport to be a critical part of that and have the infrastructure ready. And then we'll stimulate the airline demand so that more airlines are choosing to fly to and from Cork.
Okay, just there's three things that jump to mind as I talk about that. And I suppose it's local, European and transatlantic are the things that come to mind. Do we really need local flights in Ireland, a country the size that it is? Should there really be domestic flights between airports in Ireland?
I think generally there shouldn't, if the road and other forms of domestic transportation are sound. I could see an airline wanting to fly Cork to Dublin, because there certainly would be demand on certain days of the week. But is it really necessary? I don't think it's probably not.
So for environmental reasons, is this something that should be discouraged?
I don't think it should be discouraged for those reasons, because if you take the particular aircraft that would do it, they would be ATR aircraft, which are environmentally very, very good. So if you take Emerald Airlines, who fly those ATR aircraft run by Conor McCarthy and team, that's a very good aircraft for sustainability. So I think there would be demand. Look, if you had Cork Dublin on a Monday morning back on Thursdays, you do that and people would use Dublin as a hub. You know, at the moment, Cork is sending a lot of passengers to Schiphol to fly KLM, to Heathrow to fly BA, to go around the world. So you could send a bit of that Dublin's way. So I could see an argument for that. But in general, Ireland as an island should be more focused on year-round European connectivity and then year-round global connectivity. You know, we're the fifth biggest hub to North America. We have no connectivity to South America. We have no connectivity to India. We have very limited connectivity to Southeast Asia. We have no connectivity to Africa beyond Ryanair to Morocco. So, you know, people say, oh, Dublin's maxed out, and we have a very good schedule at Dublin. But there's 90,000 Brazilians living in Dublin. They all fly Dublin, Lisbon, to then go home to Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo. We should be doing Dublin, Sao Paulo. We should be doing Dublin, Mumbai. We should probably
or
be
from
Dublin,
Cork,
Bangalore.
Or does it have to be out of Dublin?
Doesn't have. No, I think, look, for Sao Paulo, India, Southeast Asia, it's going to be Dublin first. If I take the Cork schedule, what do I think are, like, if you take the existing route network out of Cork, the first thing you'd notice is that it's very much a summer schedule. So we want to rebalance that. So the winter is much, much bigger in Cork. You know, Cork has no connectivity to Warsaw, Prague, Copenhagen, Madrid, Barcelona, Lisbon, Athens,
and
no
isn't
Berlin.
Isn't it logical? Because I know that's been said, the airlines want to fly out of Dublin, but surely there would be demand that people from all around the south of Ireland, if they wanted to go back home to those countries or to visit those, would find Cork every bit as convenient, particularly as you might find it much easier to get long-term parking, for example, before you go away.
I agree. And that's why the direction that we want to take. Now, there's been never anything stopping the airlines doing that. I think now, though, you know, it will be harder to get the slots they're looking for in 2025.
In Dublin.
They will then say, okay, we want to keep the aircraft based on the island of Ireland, and we fully support that. Hence, we're giving them the incentive to relocate some of those aircraft to Cork. But even aside of that, even if you're not relocating some of your Dublin aircraft to Cork, just grow at Cork anyway, because it really is, as much as I would say, Dublin is actually Ireland's airport, Cork is the south of Ireland's airport. Now, I'm not dissing Shannon, Kerry, any one of those airports. I wish them all well. But we do want to develop, and DA want to develop Cork as the south of Ireland airport so that it has year-round connectivity, short haul, especially in the winter, to major European cities like the ones I've called out.
What about transatlantic? Because isn't the runway big enough to accommodate transatlantic flights?
Yeah, it is. So it can take narrow-body transatlantic aircraft like the 321 LRs, which are the ones that everybody's looking to get their hands on because they're much more cost efficient. It can take those. We've had some conversations, and we will have more conversations with transatlantic carriers now that we've launched this Cork incentive, because there will be some US carriers that have come to Dublin in the past 3 years that in 2025 and 2026 won't have the slots that they hoped that they would have. You may have seen that was reported during the week that JetBlue and American Airlines were called out specifically. We'll be saying to them, yeah, but keep flying to Ireland. You know, that's what the Americans want to do. And you know, there's a massive Irish population that wants to keep coming to America. So we will be encouraging them and incentivizing them to consider Cork. Now, I think everyone should bear in mind, it won't be a like-for-like product with Dublin. Dublin and Shannon have a unique advantage in pre-clearance, which is wonderful. And it's the envy of so many airports around Europe. And
could that not be put in Cork?
That's 100% down to the Americans. Right now, if you ask either candidate who's going to be the American president, if you look at the past number of years, they really are focused on border patrol domestically on their southern borders rather than around the world. So it's much harder to get pre-clearance and to get the US government to say, yeah, we're going to add, you know, to an island with our population to have three pre-clearance locations. We're blessed to have two. Three, I think, would be a tall order. Doesn't mean we can't have transatlantic, but it would mean that if you did have Cork, New York, which I would love to be in place, you'll be arriving like you're coming internationally, not like you're coming from Dublin when you arrive like you're coming from Dallas.
You've rattled off a couple of aircraft types very comfortably and easily. Does that mean you are what I think some people call an aerosexual, that you are actually in love with aircraft and aviation?
I actually think I love travel. And then you kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how you travel. I do like airports, I must say, I always did. And I do like aircraft. Now, there's not a lot of aircraft to know, because essentially we still have only two manufacturers and there's not a huge number of models. But airports, I always did agree with Michael O'Leary when they said they're like a shopping centre with a piece of tarmac. And they are. I think learning...
They're fascinating logistically, aren't they?
They are,
actually,
yeah.
The organisation that goes into a well-laid-out and well-run airport, particularly when you have multiple terminals airports, it's like a head of credible feat of architecture.
It is. And like, doing this job now 18 months, Dublin, there's a very good guy, Gary McLean, who's the MD of Dublin Airport, and he really is the sheriff who's running the city that is Dublin Airport. But it is like a little city. You have everything from like two very different terminals, you know, and you have one We have 44 airline customers, one who's Ryanair, who wants things in a particular way. But we get grief from Emirates, who want to launch first class from Dublin to Dubai. And they're saying, but we need particular terminal conditions. So you have the full spectrum of demanding airline customers, from low cost to those wanting to do first class. You've got two very different terminals. And we want to expand and innovate what's going on. I think We've brought a good amount of innovation this past year. Like, I'm so delighted that you can get, it's the first airport in the world, I bet you can get curry chips with the new Supermax that we launched. But that's part of our wider mission to bring more varied and interesting and innovative food to an airport. Because look, we want to have sushi. We want to have a proper Italian gelato place that will give your kids ice cream. We want to have good pizza. We want to have Korean food. We want to have a good variety of food, healthy to curry chips, not saying it's unhealthy. And because at an airport, people will spend money. So we're doing this not out of the goodness of our hearts. We're doing this to make money ultimately, but we do want to bring greater variety. We want to add more lounges, use digital a lot more, because people will just do that. You know, if we were heading up to the airport right now, we should be able to go up to Fast Track and just tap and pay with Apple Pay. So that's going to be something that we launch in September. So what I would call a lot of just good retailing can come to airports. It will give passengers a better experience. It will help us make more money. But ultimately, coming back to your first question, efficient security that's safe and faster than people expect puts you in a good mood. You want passengers getting through security, putting their jackets back on, going, you know what? I thought that might take 25 minutes and it only took 5 minutes. Let's go shopping or let's buy something.
You've emphasized operational issues, but it would seem that your sort of real grow is for retailing, is it? That's where your career has been.
Most of my 25 working years have been in retail. Now, I consider a lot of what I used to do in Ryanair and what I do today is just retailing in the travel industry. You know, the Ryanair model is get you in with a low cost fare and then sell you everything else. In Dublin Airport, the charges are lower than we think they should be. So we have a version of get you on a plane and get you buying loads of stuff along the way, from Fast Track to car parks to lounges to burgers to all the good stuff that we do. So it's a similar model, what we would have called the ancillary approach in aviation. For me, it's just retail in the travel sector.
Okay. And the interest in retail, how did that develop in your business career?
I think it definitely came from being in Dunn's, stacking shelves.
And then Procter & Gamble.
In Procter & Gamble, I was in sales and I was in marketing. And you're doing everything from hard selling, negotiating, to looking at products, you know, looking at brands on display in a supermarket, in a wholesale sector, online, seeing how consumers respond at the shelf edge, seeing how consumers respond online. I've always been fascinated with just the simple thing of what makes people buy things. And I think that fascination absolutely applies to the travel sector, because what makes you choose flying to the Algarve versus flying to the south of France, it's all the same process, I think, in someone's head. You're looking for some of the same things, some different things. And that's the same whether you're, won't bring it down to buying, you know, between two different washing powders on a shelf. But if you're looking to buy Irish single malt whiskey versus Scottish whiskey, it's a type of similar decision process that you go through. I've always been fascinated with that. And I think that's always been something that just drives my own, I guess, energy and fascination with any type of business that has passengers, be they customers or passengers, a place that's trying to sell you stuff, and then the outcome, which is either joy or not so much joy.
And we will talk about Michael O'Leary in a little while, but talk to me about Alan Sugar, who indirectly caused you an issue where you were having to sell English cheddar cheese into France.
That was when I was working in Macro, which was a German owned wholesaler in the UK, and we participated in the show. I mean, it was a funny small minor incident, but I learned loads as part of the process, even from how you deal with the media, how you respond to things, and how you quickly get over it.
But tell us what happened.
Tell us what happened. I don't remember too much. I think we were part of the team's challenge was to buy stuff from us, and it was in France, but I think they were supposed to get English cheese, but we didn't have enough English cheese, something like that.
Yeah, and Alan Sugar got very annoyed with the contestant who he dropped. Yeah. You then were left to defend the honour of English cheese in France.
Being Irish. Pity it wasn't Michelin-style cheese, but there you go.
Tell us, coming back to Tesco as well then, because when you arrived back in Tesco, you arrived just at the time when the crash hit, didn't you?
Yeah, and that was, looking back, that was That was massive. I arrived back and we were hemorrhaging market share to two places, the discounters being one, but more so
Nuri. Aldi and Lidl.
Aldi and Lidl, but more so Nuri, because you almost had parity between the euro and the pound. And people, anyone living, you know, even if you were South County Dublin, you were still 90 minutes to Nuri. So the Tesco's over the border and the Sainsbury's over the border were doing an absolute roaring trade. And then the tide just went out on the Irish economy. So it was a perfect retail storm. It was really, really interesting. We tried everything, all the conventional things to try to win back market share. You know, you drop your prices, you do more promotions, you spend more on marketing, and you see, does that work? But there was a fundamental shift in the Irish economy and in the psyche of the Irish shoppers. And it was absolutely fundamental. So Tesco, Dunnes, Supervalue, Superquinn, who existed at the time, were all losing to cross-border, all losing to the discounters. So then once you run through the conventional things you can do, then we had to try something else. So then we basically decided we were going to rebase the whole offer in the store. And we made everything cheaper over one weekend by 10%, which was massive. And people said, how do you do that? Now, how do you do that is you sit down with the suppliers that are supplying you in the UK and Ireland, and you, one might be P&G, and you might say, Pringles, why are we paying you this price in Dublin and paying you that price in the UK? We want the UK price converted, converted for currency. So that's what you got to do if you want to be on the shelves. So you have those tough commercial conversations. It's still the same product for the Irish consumer. They're not missing out on anything. And we got 10% cheaper in one weekend, and we started winning market share back. And that was really, really interesting to be there doing something that was very, very brave and different, because you kind of go through all the motions of you can do a bit of this, you can do a bit of that, you can wait a bit of time and hope something else happens. Nothing was positive was going to happen in the Irish economy anytime soon, because it was only getting worse and worse and worse as successive governments were rolling out further tax increases. So we had to do something that was a massive game changer within the retail sector and make it someone else's problem. Then you kind of had, you know, currency went favorable. We stopped losing to the discounters, and then you just make it Supervalue and Dunnes' problem, and have people switch from those to Tesco because they know they're getting everything they want and they're getting good value. But it was a really interesting time to come back. Very, very challenging. But I would look back in that period and say that was it was really great to be part of that.
But you did that for about 3 years, and then you decided to go back to the UK. Was that partly down to feeling, well, Ireland's banjaxed?
No. They asked me to come back to the UK. I had a good innings here, and then I was asked would I come to the UK to help them sort out something.
Tesco's in the UK.
In the UK, yeah.
But you didn't stay for that very long with them.
I think I stayed there 2 years, and then I got headhunted to go to a job in Money Supermarket, and then I went from there to Ryanair. So you'll have times when people kind of tap you on the shoulder and say, would you go and do this? I wanted, Money Supermarket was interesting because it was a wholly digital piece, and I was going to stay there and ideally run the business. And then I got a shout from Ryanair to say, would you come back and do this? So I really did love working in Tesco. I still love shopping in Tesco, shopping the little one in Sandymount, and I still like going in there going, I wouldn't do this, I wouldn't do that. Really like this, like the layout, different things, how they're using technology. Club card prices are fantastic. It's the best thing I've seen launch in retail in a long, long time. If you're going up to buy a product, that's 12, but if you've got a club card, it's 9. And you're thinking, wow, €3 savings just on one product. What's not to like about that? I'm talking about retail. I really do like it, but it's people shopping and people making choices.
And of course, we should mention, as we're doing the Cork Love-In, that it's a Cork man who is a year behind me, another commerce graduate from UCC, Ken Murphy, who now runs the entire Tesco global network. But when I told Ed, our producer here, that you were coming in for today's interview and that you had spent 6.5 years in Ryanair, his immediate response was, my God, and he survived that. So is that what it's like working for Michael O'Leary? But actually, before we get that, he tapped you up. So tell us about the approach. How did he know you? Why did he pick on you?
I would have, when I was working in Tesco Ireland, I would have known Michael Cawley, who was one of the exec at Ryanair at the time. And myself and Michael Cawley met Michael O'Leary once when I was in Tesco Ireland in his office, just to go through some things I thought any airline should look at in terms of good retail practices for online, for selling product, for kind of understanding enough about your customers, your passengers in their case, and trying to make more money out of them. So that was an interesting conversation, I guess, that put me on the radar. And then I got tapped up and I would have met with him a few times. And then I was back in Dublin.
So what was it like working for Michael O'Leary?
I really enjoyed it. I learnt loads. He's mercurial. He's challenging. He is, I think, without doubt. You know, the Irish are really good at aviation. And you could look at, you know, we're good at airports. We invented leasing. Tony Ryan invented Ryanair, but Michael O'Leary was really the architect of Ryanair. And if you look at what Michael has done at Ryanair, and if you look at what Willie Walsh did at IAG, you really go, wow, there's something in the water when you can produce airline bosses that good, that have done very, very different things. Michael, genius at simplicity, keeping the focus, keeping the place well-drilled, keeping costs down. Willie, I think, a genius at saying, what are the, you know, full service carrier, multi-brands, multi-AOC, different countries, acquiring those businesses, both very different challenges, but they've both done a really, really excellent job. So the Irish are good at this. He was challenging to work for, inspiring to work for. He's a very nice man. You know, at times people will say, really? But no, he is. He's sound and he's very, very normal. He's very, very driven. I think the engine that he has is absolutely incredible. He gets nearly everything right. No one gets everything right. And it was enjoyable to work for him.
We had Michael Corcoran on as the previous guest of Magnified, who ran social media for a while in Ryanair, and he was very interesting. And he had no complaints about working for Michael O'Leary either. He had one or two other people that he had issues with, and the rest of it. But the one thing that I've been told by multiple sources over the years in relation to Michael O'Leary is that how hands-on he is. So how good was he about letting you make your own decisions rather than having to be involved in making those decisions for you or with you?
He's quite hands-on and then he's quite hands-off depending on the topic. He's not familiar with every single topic. Certain things like the media, he's fascinated with. Look, he loves buying aircraft. He likes the hedging piece. He likes where the airline's going to fly, but he's not in every single pie that's being manufactured in Ryanair. And I don't think anybody could be, given the fact that it's
the world's biggest
airline. You had to know your stuff. A couple of times a year, you would be tested on different things. But once you pass the test, I generally found that you were let do your own thing. A lot of what I was responsible for was stuff that was outside his immediate frame of reference. So generally, I found that you just let you get on with it. And he saw the results. Like, I was there and look, we put another 12% load factor on the aircraft. That's monumental, understanding how their P&L works. And then that's 12, you know, that's another 20 people on every flight that you can flog stuff to. And then we did a much better job on digital because, you know, the vast, nearly all Ryanair flights are booked online. So that's someone who just wants to get that P&R flight confirmed. And then you've got weeks, months to sell them everything else that you can sell them. And we started to make a lot more money on that front. And that was new for him. And then he quickly became fascinated with it. But generally, to answer your question, I found him to be the right balance of being hands-on and hands-off. Has it made me a more hands-on boss? Yes, it has. I'm sure the people who work for me would probably say, wow, he's asking us questions that we weren't asked before. I think that's what...
Is that the main thing you learned from him?
Tesco is a very hands-on business too, as a retail business. You know, you don't stand back and manage retail from afar strategically. You manage it at the shelf edge. And I think Michael, while he never worked at retail, had that approach. So I think
he did. He started with his newsagents out in Walkinstown Roundabout.
Yeah, he did. That shop I never went
into.
And
he also had hospitality for his uncle in the hotel business. Yeah. And so he would spend time doing that in college as well.
Yeah. So look, I think everybody should stack shelves. Everybody should pull pints and work in a bar because it does give you social engagement skills. But I think every CEO, look, it depends. If you're running a bank, maybe you don't need to be doing the bureau de change in the summer months. But if you're running an airline, if you're running an airport, which is an operation, I think you have to, if you've got people coming through your door making choices, I think you have to understand that. And Michael absolutely did that. And it does give you a need that you understand how the key things work in the business, which people can say that's very hands-on. They can say it's not strategic. But what's so strategic about airports? You know, we want to grow them. We want to make them more innovative, but it's the daily grind of passengers in, passengers out. Like today, for example, we'll have 115,000 passengers at Dublin. That's bigger than Croke Park. It's about first wave. It's about throughput, getting them through security, getting them to the gates, keeping the toilets clean, keeping the outlets open where they can buy stuff, getting them shopping duty free. It's about the basics. And that's the bit that never gets boring and you have to keep the focus on.
Why did you leave Ryanair after 6 and a half?
I wanted to do something new. I knew Michael was going nowhere.
Why did you fancy yourself as a possible boss of Ryanair?
I didn't fancy myself as a boss of anything, actually. But I just thought I wanted to do something new. Ryanair in dog years is 6 and a half is definitely 10.
Isn't it 7 dog years per year? So it's like 42 years.
I did well out of it. I had learned loads. I thought, you know, the next number of years will be a version of the same. So I just wanted to kind of, didn't know what I wanted to do next, but I knew I wanted to take a bit of time for me, for family, chill out a little bit. And then the pandemic hit. I didn't leave because I wanted to be a CEO. And I probably would have been one of those people who said, I was a bit of a Cassius, thinking I was always a good number two, but never cut out to be the number one. Now I'm doing a CEO job. I actually like it. I haven't changed myself going about it because I think that's the worst thing you can possibly do. And that's what brought me to the DA. And a year and a half in, it's going well. And I really like the job. Never, never struggle getting out of bed in the morning doing this job.
Okay, a couple of things. Look, we've touched on it a few times, but the cap in Dublin Airport. What are you going to do about that? And what do you feel about the government, inaction in relation to it?
Well, on the government piece, look, it's inaction. Is it inaction? No, I don't think so. I think
it's deliberate stalling to make sure that you can't go above the 32 million cap because the Green Party is in position of holding the portfolio.
I think the government can answer for the government, but I think they're saying, look, planning is planning. We can't have any state-owned business going against planning. And the way we get the cap lifted, ultimately, in their view, is through the planning process. Now, how do we get the cap lifted in the planning process? Because, look, it could induce schizophrenia for me at times, because we really are a growth business. We want to grow. We've got airlines chomping at the bit over here, wanting to come to Dublin, wanting to grow at Dublin, but we're having to comply with planning. In my view, the only way the cap gets lifted is through planning. And that's, you know, we've submitted planning last year to grow to 40 million, build new piers, et cetera, et cetera. Before the end of the year, I think we will submit an additional planning application, which will say remove the cap at Dublin Airport and give us operational flexibility, but we won't be building anything. And we will look to have that move through the planning process much faster. It should, because we're not building anything. Other things might happen and litigation could come into play. So, you know, the IAA, who's the regulator on slots, who ultimately determine what's the passenger number through that slot process, they've introduced a new parameter that will be challenged by several parties. I think ultimately what's going to happen, Matt, is that this is going to end up in Brussels as a competition ruling versus domestic planning. And already lots of airports around Europe are really, really fascinated at the cap at Dublin because they think it's going to go to Brussels. And it will be determined that European competition law takes precedence over national planning law, in which case then the cap would be removed if certain airlines say that it's anti-competitive.
But hold on, isn't the cap in relation to access via road to the airport rather than anything to do with environmental concerns such as emissions or noise?
It is. It's a really archaic condition that's now 18 years old. It was designed at a time when Dublin was in a different place, when road congestion was really, really bad. Traffic congestion to and from Dublin Airport isn't a problem these days. And that's the premise on which the cap was put in place. Now, in 2006, when the cap was put in place, you just had Terminal 1. You didn't have Terminal 2. Terminal 1 was shut down a couple of times a year for health and safety issues. The place was so packed. That's not the case anymore. And at that time, you know, 5% of passengers used to come to Dublin Airport on the bus. Today, with over 32 million passengers, 35% of passengers are coming on the bus, which is great for the environment. It's even helpful for car parking. But the condition, the logic for the cap is out of date. I think generally everybody accepts that, but it's still the law. It only stops becoming the law when it gets removed as being a passenger cap or when it gets replaced with something else.
Would you like a rail line into the airport?
I'd love one. We should do that. So the Clongriffin
Michael O'Leary does not agree. He believes it would be a waste of money. He just wants people to go by bus.
Has he
changed his position?
You know, we all should take the long, long-term view. I previously mentioned that in 25 years, Cork needs a 7 million passenger airport. In 25 years' time, if you take the CSO data, look at Dublin, Dublin will need a 50 million passenger airport. I would absolutely today start work on the Clongriffin to Dublin airport rail link. I would absolutely keep going with the Metro link, and I would give the travelling public the choice. We will be quickly up on that 25-year, 50 million Dublin airport hypothetical number that I'm talking about. So we're going to need it. So I would take a long-term view, build now and get on with it rather than catch up late.
You're making one assumption, which one of our previous guests and Magnified, John Gibbons, the environmentalist, would be going nuts listening to this, is that there's going to be continuing growth in air traffic. When a lot of environmentalists say that's the last thing we need, we've got to cut down on people flying. And rather than dramatically expanding the number of passenger movements into and out of Ireland, we should arguably be reducing them. So where do you stand on environmental issues and the damage that many people believe that aviation causes?
And aviation is absolutely responsible and needs to be very, very responsible. Aviation is about 3% of the global emissions. So I think that's the important context. Sometimes aviation is put up as the poster child that got it all wrong and is doing all the damage. I would take a long-term glass half full view and say, I'm absolutely convinced by 2050, between synthetic aviation fuel, hydrogen cells in aircraft, that the technology will have evolved and we will be able to continue to travel. I don't have a view that, because we know global warming is happening, and it is happening, and all industries, including aviation, are responsible. But when you're an island like Ireland and you're absolutely dependent on connectivity, if we now turn our back and say aviation can't grow, all that's going to happen is that it's going to grow elsewhere. And that's going to cost jobs. That's going to cost inward investment into Ireland. So I think we need to get the balance right. We're doing that because we're fully committed to being net zero by 2050, but we're fully committed to serving Ireland's connectivity needs also by 2050. So I think we have to get a balance here in Ireland. People love to travel to Ireland. You know, on average, for every head of population, we've almost 2 visitors come into Ireland. The average Irish person flies 4 times a year. So we like to do this and we need to do this. I think we have to invest in the technologies that will allow us to continue to do this, because we all won't fit in the Dingle Peninsula and we all need a bit of sunshine. So that's the view that I would take. Now, there's plenty of things you do along the way. You want to incentivize people who've got newer aircraft, greener aircraft. You want to penalize people who've got the opposite. And we want to work with the airlines on scope 3 emissions. I'd be really excited about the day where we could leave here, go to Malaga, and you can say, depending on how you get to the airport you travel from, the aircraft you travel on to get to Malaga, what is the total sea emissions for that journey. And I think that's where we need to move it on to, rather than saying aviation is bad, everybody stop flying, because that's not going to work in Ireland.
Just a couple of more things. The last time I interviewed you would have been in Cork at the inaugural aviation conference at UCC. And one of the things I was actually very interested in that day was the defence you issued in Saudi Arabia. Because maybe a lot of people may not know that DAA has a very substantial international business managing airports, managing retail outlets in airports in many countries, but that probably your biggest customer is Saudi Arabia, which raises issues in relation to whether it's appropriate for an Irish state-owned organization to be hitching its wagon to that regime. And you were very, very defensive, I thought, of Saudi Arabia. Explain why.
It's appropriate for us because, look, the Irish state has good relations with Saudi Arabia and is positive about Irish businesses operating in Saudi Arabia. So that's government policy. Was I defensive? No, I'd say positive on Saudi Arabia. I hadn't been there till I started this job. And you're right. Look, we run 3 big terminals in Saudi Arabia. Every year, we're responsible for 100 million passengers in Saudi Arabia. You know, we're responsible for 36 million in Ireland. So that's just the context for listeners. And yeah, we run duty-free shops in 30 airports around the world, 14 of which are in the Middle East. So we know the region, we get the region. I'm fascinated with it because I like history and I like new places. And it's a country on the move. It really is. You could take an Irish Times view of it and say, don't go near it till it joins the Western world. they don't want to do that. They've
That's
got
a very Michael O'Leary style commentary. Take an Irish Times view of it.
But you know, if you if your view in Saudi Arabia is what you read in the Irish Times, you're never going to go there. I go there six times a year, and I'm really, really positive surprised in how the country's opening up, on how liberal the country is becoming.
My God, they're letting women drive now.
Look, divorce is happening. Divorce has happened. The rights of divorced women has really improved. We have.
They're still executing a lot of people. For that said, you can say the same about the United States of America.
There's other countries you could say that about. But look, are there things that they do and things in their history that we would look at and say, that's not the way we would do it? Yes, I think politically and historically, looking into the future, is it good for the Western world that the Middle East is on closer to being on the same side of the pitch as we are? I think that's a positive thing. I think it's good for Irish people to go and visit the region. There's plenty of good opportunities for Irish people to do business out there. On every visit I see, I'm really positive, surprised how friendly, well-educated and positive the Saudis
are. As long as you're not gay and not taking a drink.
And we have several openly gay Irish people working for us in Saudi Arabia who haven't had any problems. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not just what people read about in certain media. It's an interesting place. I would say to everybody, go out there. When I worked in Tesco, when I was going out to China, and literally every 6 months you'd go, oh my gosh, how have they done that? They've built an entire new suburb and we've opened up two supermarkets in that period. You go out to Saudi Arabia and they're getting stuff done. You know, this is a country that wants to open up 8 new airports. They want to have their own airlines. Yes, they've got loads of money, but they have an ambition and a desire to get things done that's really, really, really positive. There's not one new airport being built in Europe. So really from an aviation point of view, from a leasing industry, from an airline point of view, from an airport point of view, even from a regulatory point of view, it's probably the most fascinating country in the entire world in aviation. Culturally, I would encourage all Irish people, just go out and take a look. It's a really, really interesting place. We bring Saudis here to Cork Airport and Dublin Airport to train them up, and then we send them back and we help grow their management teams. And it's a really, really positive experience every time I go.
One other thing I'm going to ask you about, and this might be something from the Irish Times that you like, because this week it reported about a special pay review that's going on where the pay of the commercial semi-state body bosses is being compared to what they might earn in the private sector with the potential for readjustment. I suspect you were probably getting paid better in Ryanair than you get paid now, were you?
Absolutely.
Probably a multiple.
A multiple of more than four.
Wow. So you were on more than $1 million a year in Ryanair?
Look,
when you take shares and stuff.
Ryanair works you hard and you can do well in aviation in general, in airlines in general. So I'm glad, and I think everyone who's working in a state agency, CEO of a state agency would be happy with that, because I think, look, these are...
So do you feel underpaid for what you do?
100%.
Because you're on a package worth somewhere just under 300 grand a year.
About that, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the base is 285. Do I think I'm underpaid? Am I going to say, look, yes. Yeah. This is a job that brings big responsibility. You're responsible for 4,000 people. You know, we've over $1 billion of revenue. That's absolutely the case in my role, but in several other roles that exist in the sector. I think it's good that they're looking at this. Should it match the private sector? I don't think it should.
Why not?
I don't think there's... Look, you do this job. I do this job because I love aviation. I do this job because I think if I do a good job, I'm really helping Ireland. So there is a... I won't go as far to call that a vocation, but you are doing something that's good for the country. I would not match the private sector. I think that would be... You're in a different spectrum, but I would probably go halfway. That's what I think they should do. And this is my personal opinion, because if you've got good leaders of semi-state bodies, you should hang on to them. I wouldn't just look at the pay. I would look at the tenure. I have a 7-year contract. If I mess up, I should be kicked out. But if I'm doing a good job, I would just leave any CEO of a semi-state in their position.
Like the way they have done it, maybe to keep Dev McRedmond for a longer time at Unpost.
I wouldn't make it a 7, 5 or 10 year gig. I would say you're the boss of this business, do a good job, have targets, and then you should be well paid to the tune, I think, of about 50% of the private sector. Now, that would be a decent pay rise for every semi-state CEO, but I think it has to
be. So the difference is that big in your mind, is it?
I think the difference would be, if you take aviation, I think the difference would be a multiple of 3 to 5. Okay. There are individual airports half the size of Dublin Airport that are paying over $1 million to the managing director. So look, it's an issue. I think it's good they're looking at it. I wouldn't go all the way to matching the private sector because I think that would be a very, very big bill. And I don't think they need to do that. But something needs to be done if they want to hang on to talent. And not just at the CEO level, because you must remember all the other executive pay is pegged to the CEO number. So if you want to be able to hang on to talent and grow within the business, there is a need to look at pay.
And I suppose the state would get half of whatever additional pay back in tax anyway, in income tax.
And I would put targets with it. You know, I think if I was looking at this, I think for my gig, it should be, you know, there's the base pay. And if every year passengers say that the business was good and did the right thing for them, that you should have a bonus that's linked to passenger satisfaction.
One last thing, as part of the role of being a commercial semi-state boss as well, it means you get called in front of Oireachtas committees. What do you make of the type of questions you get from the politicians?
I think generally they're well informed. I wouldn't like to do it too often. If the business is well run, and I think Dublin and Cork airports have demonstrated that they're in a good place, I don't think we should be going to explain everything from A to Z of airports and everything else. So happy to go there. It's part of what we need to do. Generally good questions. A lot of it is parish pump stuff. So you could be asked by, you know, TDs from the west of the country, shouldn't the cap go in Dublin just to move flights to Shannon? You explained several times that it doesn't actually work that way. And then some questions can be a bit annoying. Look, there was one for me recently about, do I own shares in other airline? In airlines, does that conflict me as the boss of DAA? It doesn't. I think if you did a poll of airlines right now and would ask them where they are for me on a love scale, I'd be fairly low down because they're unhappy with the cap and we're not giving them everything they're looking for, but it absolutely doesn't conflict me. So some questions can annoy you. You just get on with it. You have to bite your teeth and ideally get out of there and just get back to doing what's more important, which is running the business.
Okay. And final question, will the rest of your career be spent in aviation related business, do you think?
I've a total open mind. I'm 50, but I'm still fascinated with lots of things. I love this industry. I love the retail industry. Do I think I'm going to be working in a bank? Probably not. But there's lots of other things that you could do. If work and life keep you young at heart, I think that's always a good philosophy.
Kenny Jacobs, thank you. And so that's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. We hope you enjoyed it. There are loads of other interviews in the series that you can go back and listen to if you've liked it. We recommend it, please, to a friend, wherever it is you're listening to it, be it on Apple, Spotify, or indeed the Go Loud app. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, again, thanks to our sponsors, Volkswagen Financial Services, Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you and visit vwfs.ie/business. And Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Until the next time, thank you for listening.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.